Nuclear deja vu. When is a shutdown nuclear reactor not a shutdown nuclear reactor? When a billionaire with an energy addiction and an ego the size of, well, how big can you imagine, decides that he can bring a nuke back from the dead to run his new AI data center. That's what Bill Gates is planning to do with Three Mile Island Unit 1, intending to resurrect the reactor after 5 years of shutdown. Gates and his minion seems to think that this is a spiffy idea. But then you hear from a genuine expert on Three Mile Island, or TMI as it's known, on the plans and the problems that make it not such a good idea to restart this reactor. And he tells you,
what TMI is doing, in addition to restarting the plant, they're going to ask for a license extension. They're going to ask for like the 20 years they still had on, well, 15 actually, they had on the plant, in another 20. And this is similar to what happened down at Peach Bottom when they got 80 years. So these plants are running longer, they're older, they're embrittled. And frankly, maybe some of the parts aren't available anymore. This is 1960s technology. TMI 1 came online in 74, so it's a cluster.
Well, when Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert warns you about the problems inherent in the restart of the nuclear reactor sitting next to the site of the infamous meltdown of TMI 2 in 1979, you get to see how it's really heating up in that dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we look at what's wrong with Bill Gates' plan to have the nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania restarted to power his artificial intelligence and data center. We talk with Eric Epstein, veteran activist with Three Mile Island Alert, about this shocking development. We'll also have a look back at some of the problems caused by the meltdown at TMI 2 in 1979 with a clip from a speech by Arne Gundersen of Fairwinds Energy Education on the 40th anniversary of the TMI nuclear accident. And further information on the impact of the radiation release from that meltdown in a preview from a much longer interview with Aaron Datesman based on his new book co-authored with Doug Brigge, Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the Nuke Watch Report with John LaForge, Numbnuts of the Week for Outstanding Nuclear Boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than those poor stranded astronauts up at the International Space Station have been getting. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, September 24, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out here in the U.S., where the bad news this week is that Microsoft Artificial Intelligence needs so much power, it's tapping the site of the U.S. nuclear meltdown at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania. A plan is in place to restart Three Mile Island Unit 1 following the announcement of a 20-year agreement between Microsoft and Baltimore-based company Constellation Energy Corporation, which currently owns the facility. Microsoft has agreed to buy energy from Unit 1 in order to power data centers. TMI 1 permanently closed almost half a century ago after the meltdown, which was the worst nuclear accident in U.S. history to date. Unit 1 has been closed down for 5 years, and today's interview with Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert will go into details on why attempting to restart a nuclear reactor that's been shut down for 5 years is such a bad idea. Regarding the ongoing push for passage of the Radiation Exposure and Compensation Act, referred to as RECA, this past Sunday morning, more than 50 indigenous radiation victims traveled to Washington, D.C. to protest for inclusion in RECA. Both tribal and Pueblo members from New Mexico and Arizona are included. The plan is to demand lawmakers renew the expired act and expand its coverage after House Speaker Mike Johnson tabled a bill to do so. These activists will join with others from North St. Louis, Missouri, and Utah to make their voices heard for this long overdue and necessary bill to be passed. As downwinder Tina Cordova, co-founder of the Tularosa Basin Downwinders, said, "This is not a partisan issue, and we should never view it that way. To actually say the reason for not passing the bill is that it's going to cost too much when we have spent trillions of dollars on our nuclear arsenal is obscene." In Pike County, Ohio, nuclear activists are sounding alarms, accusing the U.S. Department of Energy of a potential cover-up as workers continue to excavate around the highly controversial Little Beaver Creek, which flows near the site of the defunct Portsmouth gaseous diffusion plant. For years, the DOE has maintained that radiation levels are, quote, within acceptable limits, the question being acceptable to whom, because activists have long challenged the official narrative, pointing to a growing body of evidence that tells a far more troubling story. We will link to an article about this that goes into quite a bit of detail on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 692. In the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's continuing efforts to promote nuclear by doing anything the industry wants it to do, the push to restart the Palisades nuclear power plant in Michigan remains on schedule. At Turkey Point in Florida, the expiration dates for Units 3 and 4 of that facility have been rescinded, allowing the licenses to run until 2052 and 2053. This despite ocean rise from climate change, ongoing hurricanes, and in summer, intake water so hot that it cannot cool the reactors. In upstate New York, breaker fires tripped and shut down the state's largest and second largest nuclear power plants, Nine Mile Point Unit 2 and Fitzpatrick Unit 1. And regarding the upcoming presidential election in the United States, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists asked their experts what key questions they would ask the presidential candidates. And what they came up with was, what will you do to avoid a nuclear arms race with Russia and China? Should the president retain the sole authority to order the use of nuclear weapons? And do you agree with other world leaders that the use of or threat to use nuclear weapons is inadmissible? I'd love to see the answers from both of them. In Japan, the headline of an article in Japan Today reads, "A glitch halts again robots' attempt to get sample from Fukushima nuclear reactor." Glitch being nuke speak for gross incompetence. Radioactivity levels inside the ruins of the Fukushima Daiichi reactors are far too high for humans to enter, and earlier this month, engineers began inserting an extendable device to try and remove a small sample. However, they again had to halt the procedure this past Tuesday after noticing that remote cameras on the apparatus were not beaming back images to the control center. While touting the first successful removal of radioactive debris, all that was retrieved was 3 grams. What is stored on site is 880 metric tons. A metric ton is 1,000 kilograms or 1 million grams, so that's 880 million grams. At a rate of 3 grams a day, that will add up to 803,653 years. To remove the radioactive debris from Fukushima. The only good news is that by then, plutonium, with a radiological active life of 500,000 years, will no longer be radioactive. A Pyrrhic victory at best. Regarding the release of radioactive tritium-contaminated water from Fukushima into the Pacific Ocean, China had banned import of all seafood from Japan, but now says it will gradually resume importing seafood, quote, after the countries reached a deal that ensures the safety of water released from the disabled Fukushima nuclear plant. No word on how that assurance was suddenly achieved, but there is now an agreement for China to begin independently monitoring the discharge of water. Now, here with an international update is John LaForge with the Nuke Watch Report.
Giant military contractors might just be too big when their own weapon systems crowd a war zone so thoroughly that their own missiles are shooting down their own fighter jets. This could be what happened in Ukraine in August when a Lockheed Martin F-16 jet fighter, piloted by Ukrainian Lieutenant Colonel Oleksiy Mes, was most likely shot down by a Patriot air defense missile. Six of Lockheed Martin's F-16s were delivered to Ukraine in August. The Patriot missile system arrived earlier in the war from a General Dynamics program which was bought by Lockheed Martin in 1993. The deputy head of the Ukrainian Parliament's Defense Committee, Mariana Bazula, made the allegation of so-called friendly fire and demanded punishment for those responsible for the blunder. According to the Associated Press, the Air Force has not directly denied that the F-16 was hit by a U.S. Patriot missile system. One Lockheed Martin program making a real killing today is the F-35 jet fighter, now being sold all over the world, including to 13 European governments, most of them NATO members. Lockheed boasts that by the 2030s, over 600 of its F-35s will be operating in 10 European NATO states, the better to gear up for a permanent war with Russia. Four NATO countries that currently station U.S. hydrogen bombs at their air bases, Germany, Italy, Belgium, and Holland, are purchasing F-35s by the dozens. The F-35s are being built to carry the Pentagon's newest nuclear weapon, the B-6112 airdrop H-bomb. On March 8, 2024, the company declared that the F-35 had officially been certified to carry the B-6112. These new thermonuclear weapons are set to be delivered to the Allied NATO bases this year or in 2025, replacing the B-61s already deployed there. So the Russians can sleep a little less easily as the newest U.S. fighter jets carrying the U.S. airdrop nuclear bombs will be ready and purposed for incinerating their cities on orders from the president. The F-35s are the first ever stealth warplane certified to carry nuclear weapons. Beyond the Pentagon's nuclear-sharing NATO partners, the Lockheed Martin F-35 is being peddled to other compliant militaries, including those of Greece, Poland, Romania, the Czech Republic, Singapore, South Korea, Israel, Australia, the United Arab Emirates, Canada, and Japan. With the Pentagon itself buying 1,855 of the various F-35 versions and 19 other air forces in line for their share, a rough calculation is that Lockheed will peddle 3,615 of the $110 million jets and pocket at least $433 billion for the effort. Last year, the U.S. deployed several of the nuclear-capable F-35s to the eastern borders of NATO, operating from Estonia, Lithuania, and Romania. The Royal Netherlands Air Force has for decades trained to carry the U.S. B-61 nuclear bombs. Since the start of the Ukraine war, the Dutch have twice deployed their newly purchased F-35s in shows of force against Moscow, first to Poland, which borders Russia, and later to Bulgaria. In 2024, Lockheed Martin spent $6,434,000 on lobbying congressional offices in Washington, D.C. On September 19th last year, Lockheed sponsored the Future of Defense Summit on Capitol Hill in order to, quote, discuss how to build a more advanced defense industry and enhance deterrence, end quote. This bribery and lying in support of gargantuan military spending only leads to crimes of war or self-inflicted fatalities like Lockheed's shootdown of its own jets. Although it sells in Congress, Lockheed's nuclear weapons systems and the means of delivering them are not for defense. Their only use is to produce billions in profits at the expense of the world's crying need for basic necessities. With the colossal volume of U.S.-made jets, tanks, bombs, missiles, helicopters, artillery, and intelligence programs being sold, traded, or gifted all over the world, and particularly to Ukraine, it was inevitable that the empire's guns would eventually be fired against itself, intentionally or by accident. If the Ukrainian F-16 crash and the death of Colonel Mess is not to be repeated endlessly, and if accidental nuclear detonations are to be avoided, the United States will have to be forced to end its weaponization of international conflict and to replace its militarized foreign policy with a diplomatic one. At the Nuke Watch office in Wisconsin, this has been John LaForge for Nuclear Hot Seat.
The authors of the World Nuclear Industry Status Report 2024 shows that the world now has five times more photovoltaic power than nuclear power. The world's 408 operational nuclear reactors produce significantly less energy than solar and five times less than the world's cumulative PV capacity. We will link to this article and to the report. Another article that we will link to points out that Rafael Grossi, the International Atomic Energy Agency's Director General, is simultaneously warning us about the risk of a major nuclear accident at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, while simultaneously increasing the risk of accidents by calling for the building of more nuclear reactors. Another article we'll link to is from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists on nuclear power, future energy solution, or potential war target, which also takes into account Zaporizhzhia. And in Russian President Vladimir Putin's latest pronouncement, Russia will not test a nuclear weapon as long as the United States refrains from testing. He has also said that he has no need to use such weapons to win the war in Ukraine. But then again, there's always Zaporizhzhia. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Numbnuts of the Week.
It's a doubleheader, Numbnuts, this week, courtesy Russia. A Russian TV host and Kremlin propagandist has suggested that plywood replicas of Washington, D.C. and London should be built in Russia's Arctic and then bombed to show the nation's nuclear weapons capabilities. Vladimir Solovyov hosts a Russia One channel program where guests make frequent nuclear threats against Western countries which support Ukraine against Moscow's aggressions. He said Russia's nuclear testing ground on its Arctic archipelago of Novaya Zemlya would be the ideal location for a replica of fake versions of Buckingham Palace, Big Ben, and the White House. Alexander Mikhailov, director of the Bureau of Political Military Analysis, a Moscow think tank, said 3 billion YouTube users can see what the destruction of the capital cities of Britain and the U.S. looks like with just one of the 10 warheads on each Bulava missile. Thousands of immigrants who don't want to die for our country will erect it from plywood, and all of it will go up in flames, and it will burn so beautifully that it will horrify the world. And meanwhile, another nuclear bomb will have been exploded in the atmosphere. Oh, goody. Meanwhile, Vladimir Putin's state visit to Mongolia this month included meetings with shamans to get their blessing for the use of nuclear weapons. Putin, who has long been known by some for his special attitude to mysticism, is said to believe that without the consent of the shamans, he could not dare to take such a serious step as using nuclear weapons for fear of upsetting the spirits. And he reportedly returned from Mongolia satisfied. But according to the Society for Shamanic Practice, Shamanism is the study and practice of accumulating, storing, and utilizing power to suspend everyday laws of nature and to influence and manipulate reality for the purposes of healing, prophesying, divining, and engaging in supernatural feats. While you might look at nuclear and think, that's a little bit on the supernatural side, it is doubtful that these shamans gave any kind of approval unless they were terrified for their own survival. So no, I don't believe the spirit world is on the side of Vladimir Putin receiving shamanic approval from spirits on the other side for the use of nukes. And that's why Vladimir Putin and the idiots who want to bomb plywood replicas of Washington, D.C. and UK in the Russian Arctic, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numb Nuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, it's countdown to my birthday, this Sunday, September 29, and it's a milestone. 75. How did that happen? I'll be celebrating the day with friends, sharing storytelling, live music, sugar, and plenty of love. I have a lot to celebrate. Even at this age, I find myself ramped up, energized, and chomping on the bit to do more. More Nuclear Hot Seat, more involvement with the help of people like you. There's a lot of life left in this old girl, and 75 is the new 52. So help me celebrate. If you haven't signed up to get Nuclear Hot Seat via email every week, please do so. Go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a yellow box. Fill in your first name and email address. But bam, you get it hot off the mic every week. Secondly, my book, The Nuclear Memoir, Yes, I Glow in the Dark, 1 mile from Three Mile Island to Fukushima and Nuclear Hot Seat, is still available on Amazon. And the royalties from sales help keep me going financially. So consider purchasing a copy for yourself or as an early holiday gift. And finally, in honor of my birthday, a donation to Nuclear Hot Seat is the perfect size and color. Any amount is welcomed, be it a one-time gift or a monthly recurring amount of as little as $5. In the spirit of the day, say $1 for each year, $75. It will all help keep this show running and providing you with your weekly dose of nuclear news from a different perspective. Anything you donate is tax deductible because we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and if you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Don't wait. Donate now. And thanks for being part of the fight against nuclear and for helping me celebrate my birthday. Now here's this week's featured interview. In light of Bill Gates' manipulation around Three Mile Island Unit 1, it's important for us to gain a perspective from someone who has been on the front lines at Three Mile Island for more than 40 years. Eric Epstein is the chairman of Three Mile Island Alert, a safe energy organization based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and founded in 1977. TMIA monitors the Peach Bottom, Susquehanna, and Three Mile Island nuclear generating stations. For more than four decades, Mr. Epstein has specialized in research, litigation, and providing expert testimony in the decommissioning, decontamination, environmental safety, rate recovery, and waste isolation issues at nuclear reactors. I spoke with Eric Epstein on Saturday, September 21st, 2024. Eric Epstein, it's always great to talk with you because we know the information is going to be clean, clear, obvious, and direct. Such a bad thing for us to be talking about. And thanks for joining us on very short notice here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
No problem.
Well, I guess there is a problem, and that's because we've just learned that TMI, Three Mile Island Unit 1, which is not the one that had the accident back in 1979, but TMI Unit 1 is slated now for a restart after having been shut down for 5 years.
Right.
Give us some of the background on what this is and how this has come about.
So both plants were in different stages of decommissioning. The one that they're going to restart, TMI-1, is owned by Constellation. And it was in a delayed decommissioning mode. So they had built an ISFI, which is an independent spent fuel storage installation. They're maxed out there. They have all their spent fuel from operating. That's TMI-1 is in that spent fuel facility. TMI-2 next to it is in an active decommissioning, although they haven't done anything. They got 1.1 billion, they being TMI-2 Solutions. So TMI-2 Solutions bought the damaged reactor, actually a private equity fund, bought that reactor saying they could decommission it and make money, which we found is clearly not the case, nor should it be the objective. So at TMI-2, what has happened is, and this occurred before the TMI-1 restart proposal, they're going to have to slow down. They don't have enough money. So they've gone from 1.1 billion to 660 million. They basically said in a meeting we had in February that they're going to pause, pause, pause the cleanup for the money to catch up. So if TMI-1 does restart, it's unlikely that TMI-2 will be cleaned up or any effort made to clean it up for a long, long time, which is what most of us thought, that TMI-2 will never be cleaned up. TMI-1 has 700 metric tons of high-level waste on the island. So you got a high-level radioactive waste reactor, TMI-2, which obviously can't restart. TMI-1 wants to restart. It's a heavy lift, Libby. They have no workforce. They have no waste space. They sold off $100 million in equipment. So they gutted the reactor. They sold off the simulator. So all this can be overcome with money. And it was just an outburst of support when this announcement was made. So this was choreographed in the dark of boardrooms and in political parlors.
How far back does that manipulation go? I mean, at what point, approximately to the best of your knowledge, after the shutdown, which was exactly 5 years ago from the date
Right.
of the announcement, they're so cute about those things.
Yeah.
How soon after that shutdown did the gears start moving to put this buyout and restart in place?
Really, quite recently. So I'd say February, March, when Dominguez, the CEO, was on a conference call with Wall Street and said that, they were asked him about what was going on in Palisades with resuscitating that zombie nuke. And he said, it wasn't a lot, that there's something may occur here. Tim Judson called me and said, look, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but.
Tim Judson, who is the head of Nuclear Information Resource
Right.
Center.
I said, Tim, good to know. We've been hearing things. Look, we're not really that far from Peach, and we're not that far from Limerick. And we were hearing that workers were being solicited to train to stay in the area. And if you look at the nuclear constellation for Constellation, you have Limerick near Philly, TMI in Harrisburg, Peach Bottom on the York border, and then Calvert Cliffs. So this is a heavily concentrated nuclear corridor. We were absolutely not surprised. We held a press conference a couple of weeks ago, and it was clear that we're on an island, so to speak. It's like being back in 1978. Everybody is so zestfully blinded by this pro-nuclear glitter that we anticipated this might happen. So we are prepared to litigate. It's not something we thought we would be doing. But what TMI is doing, in addition to restarting the plant, they're going to ask for a license extension. So they're going to ask for like the 20 years they still had on, well, 15 actually, they had on the plant. I think 2034 was the initial drop dead date, and another 20. And this is similar to what happened down at Peach Bottom when they got 80 years. So these plants are running longer, they're older, they're embrittled. And frankly, maybe some of the parts aren't available anymore. This is 1960s technology. TMI-1 came online in 74, so it's a cluster.
So, in the past 5 years, not only has it been shut down and just sitting there like a car up on blocks, but they have gutted the equipment from it and there
Right.
hasn't been maintenance done on the facility. What makes this so appealing to someone like Bill Gates, or I don't know that there is anyone else like Bill Gates, but Bill
Right.
Gates? What is so attractive to him about getting this nuclear facility up and running again.
Yeah, this makes sense to him. He's a nuclear zealot. You know, he's trying to start a facility of his own out west. I believe it's Wyoming, maybe Utah.
Wyoming.
And so you have, look, the data corridor in Northern Virginia is filled up. To the north of us, Berwick cut a deal with Amazon in May. So the nuclear plant to the north of us in the coal region has an agreement to sell between 120 and 960 megawatts to Amazon. That plant is co-located. Amazon bought 1,600 acres for $650 million. So that's the first instance of a nuclear power plant being located next to a data center. That's Amazon. So we're contesting that. You know, it's a rough slog, but what they got there is proximity to New York, proximity to water, and they're behind the meter, which is a really extraordinary concept. In other words, because they're co-located, Amazon is saying they don't have to pay line and wire fees, which would mean the ratepayers would be paying up to $140 million to subsidize Amazon to take electricity off the grid. So what teed this up was the conference call with Wall Street that Dominguez had in the spring. Late spring, you have Amazon doing a co-facility deal with Talen Energy. Talen Energy has about 1,200 megawatts, and they have the option to take up to 960. We're also on the corridor for warehouses. We have a strategic location there for the Commonwealth State.
So these are all things that are heavy users of electricity.
So what I'm saying is we were aware that something was going to drop because of location. We had water, Susquehanna River. We have potential electric with these nuclear power plants, and the data centers need energy 24/7. And then there was the scare tactic that, look, all the data centers are coming, we need electricity, let's resuscitate the nuclear plant. So hopefully that folded somewhat neatly into the background, but we were not surprised.
So basically, Bill Gates, one of the richest people on the face of the planet with virtually unlimited money to throw at this, is behind rejuvenating a nuclear plant that has been closed down for 5 years and for which there are a myriad of problems, which he doesn't see as problems because he can just throw money at it.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? This is a different arrangement than at Palisades. There's not going to be any state money in this. And this is kind of how they sold it. And although they're going to get a loan, I haven't seen the details. Microsoft may be signing off. It makes perfect sense for Bill Gates, who's, you know, he's a high priest of technology, to go back to TMI and have it restart 50 years after the accident. He would probably view that was a crowning moment in his career. So we knew for the last couple months it was going to be Microsoft. We really thought that this wouldn't drop until the spring after the fall legislative session. But I got to tell you, Libby, we got steamrolled. They were really, really well coordinated between labor, politicians, the corporation. Everybody was on the same page. The press release was embargoed until 9 yesterday. And the way I found out was kind of extraordinary. I'm a school board director, and some of our schools are within 10 miles of the plant. So we were notified that we have to reinvigorate our emergency plan. It's exhausting because I think, and you may have talked about this on your show, with the passage of the ADVANCE Act, the NRC is essentially just a promoter, not a regulator. So we are looking for other venues. It's a deregulated state, so it won't go through the Public Utility Commission. It will have to go through the Susquehanna River Basin Commission. We feel we can have a fair shot there and the DEP, but this, what do they say, the nightmare scenario. It was hard to imagine that this could have happened, Libby, about a year ago, and then it was bad mojo.
With this happening so quickly and so overwhelmingly, because I've certainly been aware of the, pardon the expression, the tsunami of press releases with the identical talking points coming from all different areas. So it sounds like it is consensus before there can be any oppositional voice coming in. With this kind of manipulation of public consent, because that's what public relations is, it's the manipulation of consent. What options do those who oppose this, who see the ridiculousness of this and the danger of this, have to follow to try and certainly trip it up, slow it down, ultimately to stop it, but for now, just put the brakes on and inject a little bit of common sense or critical thinking into this process?
You have a really brilliant observation. I've never seen anything choreographed like this between labor, management, Democrat, Republican, legislature, the governor. It was impressive. The problem is, this is not a public policy. They looked to a poll, the poll they got that said people were favorable. We pointed out the same entity did a poll in the spring and it wasn't favorable. But public policy made in the dark is never good. So we need to stretch it out, the process. We need to have the public involved. I think the public is going to find out real quickly that there is no process. I mean, 44 years out from TMI, I had a guy come and interview me yesterday from CBS who said he had never heard of Three Mile Island until he was assigned to go interview me. And I just said, wow. So we have our work cut out, but I think, we have character, we have integrity, we have a lot of skill sets. We've been doing this for a while. So we will contest at every venue that we can. And I'm a little more optimistic about some than the others. But, the zeitgeist that's here, this pro-nuclear ecstasy almost, it's appalling and it's deflating. So we just have to stay at it. And again, this is like September 1978 when we were on an island. Back then, we at TMI Alert was opposing the start of TMI Unit 2. We were on the periphery, we were on the margins, and we're at the same place, unfortunately.
What kind of timeline is being proposed by Microsoft and Bill Gates to get this nuclear reactor up and running?
Constellation has taken the lead and they've given an inventory of issues they need to address. They did their due diligence prior to this and said they could restart it, but the regulatory process is much more expedited. Not just after the ADVANCE Act, but over the last 10, 15 years as the NRC has retreated. It's difficult to get standing. In other words, to prove that you'll be adversely affected by the restart of the Three Mile Island. They will fight us hard on that. And this is where Bill Gates' money helps. I'm sure that we're going to be up against Constellation and Microsoft. Then, if you get standing, if you can get a contention in, and it's no secret, we would be looking at the steam generators. Candidly, we think they're deficient. You're looking at an island that's floods. Some places are below the floodplain where they store radioactive waste. They have done nothing to address climate change. So there's issues that are real, intangible, and that'll be protracted. But when you're going up, I mean, Libby, some of these attorneys are making $1,000 an hour. That's me in a month. So it's you can't be intimidated. But I think for this, this is an accident without an end. And this was a postscript none of us foresaw. Well, we're here, we'll have to deal with it, and we'll fight through it. Giving up is not an option. And I think the longer we have legal engagements with the company and Microsoft, the more light we put on this issue, I think the better. But for right now, we got steamrolled. Look, you had a great observation. I've never seen such a coordinated media effort in my life between Republicans, Democrats, legislature, governor, union. I mean, it was like, so here's the thing. You can throw the punch. Can you take one? It's 15 rounds, man. This is red, white, and blue. Red-blooded, white collar, blue collar, man. It doesn't matter. So we will be here. And we also, there was a proposal before the Susquehanna River Basin Commission to conserve water. And for some reason, the Nuclear Energy Institute lost their mind in a filing. So I was thinking, wow, they've never intervened here. They're now basically telling us that the water conservation that we want to do is harmful to nuclear. So not a complete surprise. Yeah. So it's interesting because I've also heard rumblings that Peach Bottom may cut a similar deal.
So the nuclear facilities are now being co-opted by artificial intelligence and data centers that need so much electricity that these facilities that were built in large measure with public funds, with taxpayer money, are going to be converted into private entities at probably, pennies or less than pennies on the dollar and be used to fuel these major data hogs to continue to manipulate and limit our options in life.
Well, you also to limit your options in consuming electric, they're essentially taking electricity off the grid. And although Pennsylvania is deregulated, transmission and distribution charges can still be recovered. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I know the Public Utility Commission is not happy about the Talen Energy and Amazon agreement. Look, Shapiro is very powerful and people fell in love with him. He's also very pro-nuclear, and people, I think, are worried about their political wherewithal to stand up to him or the legislature. And look, the most surprising thing is gas. Pennsylvania is the second largest gas producing state. We export 30% of our gas. When we fought the bailout in 2019, gas was an ally. They're not in the game. So we'll see how this plays out. And remember, we are the second most concentrated nuclear state in the country after Illinois. We've got five plants, numerous reactors. So right now is just, I guess, if you step back and look at it and said, if it's going to happen, where else but TMI? And I think that's symbolic. I don't think that's lost in the industry. And you had an excellent observation, 5 years to the date of when they shut it down.
That was no accident.
No, it wasn't. And then it comes on a Friday, so you're stonewalled over the weekend with the media, but it's what it is. Look, clearly it's a body blow. We'll get up, answer the bell, and keep swinging.
And may Heidi Huttner's film be a resource that can help you in this battle.
Anything can be a resource that in this battle, Heidi's film or the San Onofre syndrome, or what I've noticed within the 3 Mile Island community, most of the people that have experience are much older. So how we communicate has to change too. So if the films can do it, San Onofre syndrome, radioactive, whatever it is, that's great. I believe that we're going to have to be much more aggressive in social media where we're getting killed. We're talking about people who I started out with where the most advanced technology was a mimeograph machine.
Rotary phones.
But anything that can destabilize what is really, there's no debate, it's a one-sided onslaught. And the most chilling aspect is young people have just ingested this nuclear opiate.
They haven't had as strong a voice against it as has been the millions and millions that are spent on it. And they also do not see the connection between weapons and energy. For them, weapons bad, bombs bad, let's get rid of the bomb. But they don't see that nuclear reactors are intrinsic to the process of creating the plutonium that's used in the bombs. They've been separated off from each other, so people think of them as two separate issues when really it's all the same.
Well, what I have found is that most Americans have the attention span of a fruit fly.
You are insulting fruit flies there.
So TMI is just as remote as Columbus coming to America. And Chernobyl, very little knowledge of. Fukushima, a bit, but what it takes, and I hate to say this, it's human nature is something bad for something good to happen. And so folks are in their own worlds, in their own lanes. It is gonna be a challenge.
Well, here we go again.
Yeah.
If listeners who are coming out of shock over this were to get involved in some meaningful way, what would be most useful to you?
Right now, I don't know. I mean, obviously, sending money is always good, but we have to go revisit the funding network to get resources. And we'll let folks know as soon as I don't want people just to do something for the sake of something. It needs to be focused, and there'll be some upcoming events for folks to plug into. And I know Gina talked to Heidi about showing the film, so My assumption is we'll probably move and time something around the anniversary of the accident.
Eric Epstein, you have been fighting the good fight around Three Mile Island for how many decades now?
Four.
And unfortunately, the battle continues, but we couldn't have anybody better in the forefront leading us on. Thank you so much for your
Will
explanation today. Keep us informed. And as
do.
always, thanks for being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Eric Epstein, chairman of Three Mile Island Alert. The group email is TMIA.com. And to contact Eric Epstein directly, go to epstein@efmr.org. We will, of course, also have the links up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 692. This seems like an appropriate time to review some of the damage done by the 1979 meltdown at TMI-2. I don't call it a partial meltdown, because that's like saying a woman is a little pregnant. Fuel melted down, radiation was released, it was a meltdown. To learn more, here's Arne Gundersen, who has more than 50 years of nuclear power engineering experience, holds a nuclear safety patent, and was a licensed reactor operator. As a former corporate officer in the U.S. atomic industry, Arne managed and coordinated projects at 70 U.S. nuclear power plants. Now, as chief engineer for Fairwinds Associates, he testifies on behalf of states, municipalities, NGOs, and environmental organizations regarding the hazards and violations at nuclear reactors and atomic waste sites. This is an excerpt from a presentation he made in the rotunda of the Pennsylvania State House on the 40th anniversary of the TMI accident on March 28, 2019.
How much radiation was released? And the answer is nobody knows. And the reason for that is that every single radiation detector in every single vent that left the plant was pegged. That when they built Three Mile Island, they really wanted to detect the low levels of radiation that would be released. And they put all low-level radiation detectors in the stack and in all the ventilation systems. But when the disaster happened, all of those went off scale high. So nobody measured what went out of Three Mile Island. So at best, scientists like me have to calculate based on what we know was measured out in the environment. The NRC on their website, very shortly after the nuclear disaster at TMI, came out with 10 million curies. Curies is a measure of radiation. And a curie is 37 billion disintegrations per second. So 37 billion times 10 million is what the NRC said. And I'll submit as part of this presentation that that's incredibly low. Most of the measurements were made by driving a car around through the local neighborhoods and out into the hillsides, and also from helicopters. And you'll look in my press packet, and I have two quotes from a senior guy at the NRC, a guy named John Collins. And John said that at best the car is iffy, and he didn't trust the helicopter data at all. Now, if you think about it, a helicopter takes pure air from above and pushes that pure air down on the radiation detector below, diluting whatever the radiation levels were. So the car data is suspect, and the helicopter data is useless. What I did was I plotted where the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looked on the first 4 days. And I compared it to the peer-reviewed paper that Dr. Steve Wing wrote. 10 years ago, I met Steve Wing right here in the rotunda. Dr. Wing was an epidemiologist at UNC. 2 years ago, he passed. A wonderful scientist. And Steve showed that there was a dramatic increase in cancer along the Susquehanna River Valley. This is peer-reviewed stuff. This went through a rigorous scientific process. What happened in the Susquehanna River Valley was that during the first couple days of the disaster, there was a temperature inversion over the valley, and that kept the radiation moving up and down the river, but it didn't allow the radiation to move up into the hillsides as much. So if you look at Steve's data, which is on these slides, but also in the material I gave you And I'll have a PDF up on the Fairwinds website after I speak at Penn Central. But if you look at that data, you'll see a clear correlation to cancer increase versus where you lived in relation to the river valley. So then I plotted on the first day where the NRC looked, on the second day where the NRC looked, on the third day and fourth day. It shows, and it's detailed in my thing, that the data was not collected in the areas where the plume was moving. So that's one objective piece of data that shows that we really don't know how much radiation was released.
More for Bill Gates to contemplate. Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Energy Education at fairwinds.org. And that's Fairwinds, F-A-I-R-E, winds.org. Finally this week, an excerpt from an interview I just conducted with Aaron Datesman and his writing partner, Doug Brigge, on their newly published book, Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. I'll have that full interview within the next few weeks, but here's a bit of new information on the TMI-2 accident, obviously an ongoing interest of mine. Aaron Datesman is a researcher and inventor living in Washington, D.C. He has held technical roles at the U.S. Department of Energy and at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. We spoke on Monday, September 23, 2024, and this segment contains new information on the radiation release from Three Mile Island. That played out very specifically in the chapter about Three Mile Island, which I was there. Your maps were very instructive to me about the fact that, yes, I was walking around outside in the exact place that was the deepest purple, meaning the greatest intensity of radiation, at the time the radiation was there. This just gave me further confirmation. Can't say it made me happy, but at least it solidified some information for me.
Yeah, you were in Middletown.
I was actually in Royalton, and I walked into Middletown along the banks of the Susquehanna River. And was outside for several hours during that day in the late morning, early afternoon. So this was of personal interest to me. And I came across a concept in there I'm not familiar with. And that is the contradiction between physical measurement of radiation dose and biological outcomes. In simple language, what does that mean and why is it important?
At the end of that chapter, I say, and I think this is a correct insight, that the proponents of nuclear power technology are principally based in the physical sciences. They're physical scientists and they're engineers. And this is the mode of thinking that they employ. So the doses, to the extent that they're known, that were measured from Three Mile Island were measured with electronic devices called thermoluminescent decimeters, or TLDs. That detail doesn't matter, but it does matter that those are electronic devices. Now, the internet is also an electronic device, and you know not to believe everything you read on the internet. It's interesting that a TLD will register 2 millisieverts or whatever was registered, but a biological indicator is actually what's necessary to determine what happens to a biological organism. I'm not a TLD, I'm a person. So my chromosomal response to the ionizing radiation is not necessarily described by an integrating detector like a TLD. To the degree that it's possible, therefore, I think what the chapter asserts is that we should be thinking about biological measures of injury. Is it possible to give a direct measurement biologically rather than with an electronic device of what happened? The fact is that that was done, and Dr. Brigge and I are doing it again.
There was one example that stood out for me where you were talking about the numbers, the level of exposure that was being presumed versus the story of an individual who lived within 4 miles of Three Mile Island reporting what happened to his body as a result of having been out there at a time and in a way that there wasn't, quote unquote, supposed to be any impact from the radiation, according to the quote unquote experts. I'm wondering how often you've been able to track and how you've been able to quantify that correlation between they say that nothing happened, but here are the examples of the people who were there and what actually happened to them.
There has been a lot of work addressing this question by people who came well before us. There's something called the Katagiri Report that I think is mentioned in a reference in the book. In terms of what we've done, I think the answer to the question is that we have examined so far 26 people for cytogenomic analysis. Those selections were based on location, so based on that plume map that's in the book that you saw in which you located yourself. But as for our own study, we haven't yet unblinded who was exposed or not exposed to reference it to the results in terms of the chromosomal injuries that we may be finding.
That was Aaron Datzman, co-author of the new book with Doug Brigge, Dirty Secrets of Nuclear Power in an Era of Climate Change. That full interview will be coming up in a few weeks.
Activists, shout out.
John LaForge of Nuke Watch brought to our attention a petition in support of anti-nuclear activist Dennis Duval. The 82-year-old U.S. citizen is a resident of Radeberg, Germany, a member of Veterans for Peace, and an opponent of nuclear weapons, specifically against the U.S. NATO thermonuclear bombs stationed at the NATO base in Buchel, Germany. Duval has been convicted for his anti-nuclear actions twice. In July of 2018 and July of 2019, he took part in two go-in actions in which the fences were broken through in order to infiltrate the NATO base in Buchel. And in August of 2023, he had spray-painted crime scene, nuclear bombs, on the road to the $10 billion base at Buchel. Because he was sentenced to a total of over 90 days imprisonment, deportation is legally possible. To learn more and to have the opportunity to sign this petition that he not be deported, we'll have a link up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 692. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 24th, 2024. If you would like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, that way you won't miss a single episode, it's easy to do. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and there is a yellow box that will pop up asking for your first name and an email address. Fill that in, click the send button, and every week you will get one, count them, one email from Nuclear Hot Seat, which contains a link to that week's show and a brief description of some of the contents. You can also sign up wherever you like to get your podcast because we are everywhere. Now, if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information via email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Consider it in honor of my landmark cornerstone birthday coming up this Sunday. Anything helps, and as always, we will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby, Halevi, and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guest whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that when it comes to nuclear, not only what you don't know can hurt you, chances are it already has. There you have it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Thanks for being here, and now, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.